This is tape two. It's still tape four. Okay, tape four, because I'm a little confused about the tapes because some of them are not real good. This is still January 30th, 1997.
December 30th.
Thank you. December 30th, 1997.
We're all getting punch drunk here, folks.
I'm having a wonderful time. And since I'm very egocentric, that's all that counts at the moment. It's still Mary Harrison interviewing, and still Gabby Dinman making notes, and still a delightful Richard Rao, who I think is getting drunk on Diet Coke, if that's possible.
You should indicate that I'm Richard E. Rao, and the E is my middle name, of course, is for my grandfather, Enoch.
Okay.
But I don't use that. I just use Richard
E. Rao.
Well,
it's good that...
Right, just so you can keep that straight.
All right, and this is side nine, then.
No. Seven. No.
Seven.
If it's the fourth thing.
Oh, right. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I'm not drinking Diet Coke.
I have, and I'm now going crazy. But anyway, I just want to finish up my, without saying anything more about it, I like the Torvald in that version of Doll's House in New York. It was a more human version of it, but I didn't go crazy over the version. But in any case, I've already been told by the ladies here in the room that I'm wrong. So
did you? No, you're not
they
wrong.
They did it without saying a word.
Did you remember the actor's name, McNaughty or something? I forgot.
I was trying to think of it, and I can't. No.
Gabby, can you? It was McSomething. Okay.
The play, however, I would like to recommend for those of you in the 21st century who hear this, is that it was is Chicago, the musical, with Bebe Neuwirth and Ann Rankin, and James Naughton and Joel Grey, and it was just about the best thing I saw in my recent travels to New York City. In February, I'm going to New York to see Ragtime, which is the big hit, and I just got tickets. I called one day, and they gave me tickets, and I'm going there because the Pittsburgh Symphony is playing in Carnegie Hall with their new conductor, Marius Janssen, and I thought that would be nice. I've never heard the Pittsburgh Symphony play in New York, though they have many times. So, and in addition to which, I'm trying to see, I'm seeing Ragtime and trying to get tickets to The Lion King, which is on Broadway right now, and probably will, I'm going to have trouble with that, but I'm going to keep after it. So that takes care of that little bit. I wanted to add a few little more items. These are here and there stuff. In 1870, my great-grandfather, Solomon Rao, the man who migrated from Philadelphia to Dubuque, Iowa, with his wife, my great-grandmother, Rosalia, they ended up in Pittsburgh in 1870, and I happened to see a census form for him, because I couldn't figure out what he did here. And all it lists him as is a dry goods merchant, so I'm assuming that's what he did. And he did that for the next 10 years, and then he died at the age of 58. A lot of what I think this is missing on the tape, but it's still missing to me as well, is my father's early life. And I really don't know much about it, so I can't, sort of like I'm throwing out something here that doesn't have any real substance to it. Though I know that later on he became a little older, a speaker. He was quite apparently a very good speaker, and a writer. And because he came from a family that wrote and was musically inclined, and I think everybody in the family was sort of connected in that direction. And so here I am in the 1990s writing for a newspaper occasionally. And so that's about it there. I found out something about my great-grandmother, but unfortunately for this tape, it's useless, because I found out that in 1918, at the end of the First World War, my grandmother, who she must have done this 1,000 times, formed an organization, a World War I organization to help the soldiers overseas, and the initials of it are SSS, but unfortunately for this... For this taping, I forgot to write down what it was. I have, however, Xeroxed or made a copy of the editorial in the Jewish Criterion, which was the magazine in those days, which actually is a full paragraph detailing the forming of this organization. She was so involved in so many organizations of a charitable nature that it's almost impossible to believe. And this one I just stumbled upon for the first time and did not know about. All of my family, including me, were all philanthropists of one form or another. We give money to different organizations. I admit, though, that my giving has been more narrow in the sense that it's to theater organizations rather than the general betterment of mankind. But that may change. I may start moving around and doing different things. At this moment, I can only say, because I don't know yet, that in the Hillman Library, in the Curtis Collection, is a large collection of materials called the Rao Papers, which is devoted to my grandfather, Enoch Rao, and my grandmother, Bertha Florsheim Rao. However, there is a possibility, as of this taping on December 30th, 1997, there'll be some material given over to the John Hines Historical Center, but I haven't reached an agreement with them about this. The idea is not to split the collection up into different things. So for example, I have in my possession my grandfather's top hat, his gold cane with his name on it, and the inkwell he used as a city councilman. Well, the Historical Society likes that kind of artifact material, and the Hillman Library does not have as much of a need for that. But so it may end up that the collection will be, if you research it, will be in two different places, but that is as of the moment. Something that I left out, just of a very quick nature, my grandmother, Bertha Florsheim Rao, had a brother named Berthold Florsheim. He was a bachelor, and he died in 1966 at the age of 96. He was the one that had all the money in the family. He was the one that made all the suggestions, and he's the one that had all the stocks, and he's the one that was involved in the engineering works at Gary, Indiana, and he was a surveyor, and he had his own company. He also spent a lot of time in Brookville, Pennsylvania, and I'm not sure what he was doing up there, but he did. And he used to say there were three evils in the world, and they are the invention of the car, the fact that women got the vote. And the third one was that when they, in 1913, enacted the income tax. Of course, that one was the worst of all. And he was a staunch Republican all his life and hated Franklin Roosevelt, where my father, on the other hand, thought that Roosevelt was the greatest god of our century. And I also agree that he was the greatest president of our century, but that may be open to criticism because some people may like Woodrow Wilson or maybe Eisenhower, but I thought Roosevelt was terrific based on what I read, because I was only 5 years old when he died in 1945. But Uncle Bert, as we called him, and really he's my great uncle, he was a character of all kind at time. He was this 19th century character. Here he had been born in 1870. By the time the century began, the new one, he was 30. And of course, he was used to his ways. And he was a very, very, very meticulous bachelor. And he lived on the third floor of my grandmother's home on Bartlett Street, where he stacked up U.S. News and World Reports. And he did something which I, to this day, regret deeply. He invented things, and when he died, I did not save the inventions. I know. Remember, ladies, I was 26 years of age, and I was not in a historical framework the way I am now. Now I would save everything.
Do you have any idea of what some of the inventions
No, are? Absolutely not. I completely blotted them out of my mind, and that's another thing that bothers me. You see, my mother wasn't particularly of a historical, she wasn't interested in this either. And so she said to me in 1966, he had died in April of 66, will you go over to the house and do whatever you have to do, get rid of the books, settle the situation. And imagine, here I am, saddled with this business of getting rid of thousands of books, all kinds of artifacts. I gave up things today, some of which I will not mention in this thing, that will make me ill again, all over again. However, I did give 1,500 books to the Hillman Library. Unfortunately, in those days, they didn't have any way of cataloging correctly. So there's no list of what I gave. It's just that in the Hillman Library are books, and inside there may be given by Richard E. Rao and Helen Wayne Rao in memory, I guess, or something like that. And they're all over the place, but I have no idea what they are anymore. I know there were a lot of art books, but I can't tell you.
Couldn't catalog.
They didn't have this is pre-computer.
Sure.
There's no list of it. There's a catalog. Oh, the books are done, but there's no inventory of this collection of books. It's just unbelievable that this would happen. But nevertheless, they have it. At least it's somewhere. But a lot of other things were given away, including pictures that this family had amassed over a long time. And I guess I just couldn't. It was too overwhelming to me, and therefore I did not have the interest or the brains to keep them. And the inventions bothered me tremendously. It just never occurred to me that the stuff could be stored. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I did save things, but not as much as you would think. But Uncle Bert was such a character that when my mother married into the family, he was not thrilled about it because she was an actress. And he was a captain of industry, a businessman, and he thought of an actress as somebody who might, you know, just take the money and run. So the deal was that when my father married my mother, that my grandmother insisted that they not have a child for 5 years. So I gained a few years. So instead of being now perhaps 61 years of age, I'm only 57.
There you go.
See, I gained a little time. But Uncle Bert came to like and admire and respect my mother over the years, and very much was, you know, relied on her, and I think he liked me. I think he found that I was some kind of like, since he never married, like a son he never had. And I remember one day I was up on the third floor, I visited him after I was playing tennis. And he said to me, now, Dick, he called me Dick. He said, Dick, I want to know what you intend to do someday. What are your plans for the future? And I said, well, I don't know. I think maybe I'll be a teacher. He said, well, you have time to think about it. See, he wouldn't even give that profession much of whatchamacallit. The other interesting thing about him, which we never quite understood, and since he was a bachelor, he had a woman in his life who apparently they would meet in Chautauqua in the summer. And her name was Mrs. Gregory, and the story was that before he showed up at the hotel up there, she would take her perfume and spray it around the hallway before he got there. Now, this is really apocryphal. I don't know if this is true or not. He rarely ever talked about her. I never saw a picture of her. I don't know if... But she lived into her mid-90s also.
She from Pittsburgh, right?
I think. I don't know that either. But in any case, he, generally speaking, had very little use for anybody other than his money. But at the same time, he was interesting. And I saved 10 of his letters to me. And they're all written in the form of the 19th century almost. He, very florid style, but very... very, very old-fashioned, very interesting to read. For example, I think in one letter he says, yours of the 10th instant, which was an expression, of course. Yeah, and you know, in those days, this was, but even in the 1950s, the letters I have are from the 1950s, and he was 80, in his 80s then. And he would say, I am very pleased of your progress at your educational activities. You know, it was all very almost wordy, where we would come up with a simpler word. He would use the, and I think that he was just a fascinating person, and I'm sorry I didn't really spend a lot more time with him, talk to him. Just, I think he was a lonely old guy, you know. He never got married, so he didn't mind company. We'd just sit up in the third floor, and those U.S. News and World Reports would pile up. I remember going into his room thinking, my God, and this is like what Crap's Last Tape talks about. I could use a little of that in my characterization this summer. But he wasn't an unhappy man, and he seemed to be very powerful. And he was, up until he was 93, still driving his car. And apparently I heard the police downtown were not happy about it, because he would come barreling downtown to his office at the Farmers Bank building. And I would say to my mother, well, what does he do there? And he would look at his stocks every day, pore over them, look at them. And he was a fascinating guy. He wrote poetry. I have some examples of his poetry at home. And in 1939, my father decided for my grandmother's 74th birthday, not her 75th, to record a record, and he's on it. He's on it, my mother's on it, the young bride, who has a great voice, my aunt's on it, my father is on it. It sounds like an old record. It's an old 78. However, it's just fascinating. But he was a very interesting guy. And I wanted to add that. And remember now, I'll repeat what the evils of life are for him. The invention of the car, the women getting the vote, and the establishment of the income tax.
You mentioned the Historical Society and what you're planning at this point, of some of the artifacts of your grandfather and the hat, etc. Does the Historical Society have any of your things yet? That would be a first event.
No.
All yes. Hillman.
Yes. All that exists are these papers at the Hillman. Yes, and there are no pictures. You see, there's another problem here. In 1981, my mother and I gave over to the Hillman Library, to the Curtis Collection, the entire collection of Playhouse stuff, which the board had empowered us to do. So at the Hillman Library is as much as we can say of the Playhouse material, which includes press book, newspaper clippings of all the events at the Playhouse from 1934 to 1974. They have many, 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 many pictures of many of the productions with negatives of all of these, but they have gaps too, because they can't find, because they were thrown out. They also have minutes, many minutes of the organization, and hundreds of photographs. Unfortunately, none of my mother. And I asked them why they don't, and they said, well, we don't have them. You're supposed to give them to us. And I have not turned over to them these pictures. You see, the problem now is, if I give them to the Curtis, do I also give them to the Historical Society? So it's a bit of a problem. I have many, many photographs, and I have of her especially, because she made, as I say, she did 37 shows, but I have a lot of pictures. I also have pictures of her when she was at Carnegie Mellon, Carnegie Tech in those days. She graduated, by the way, in 1933. I want to make a correction on that on the tape. But her shows there also were, there. I have several of those. So it's I have to decide how I'm going to do this. essentially
what is the
Curtis
collection?
Where?
What is the Curtis
collection? It is a collection of many theater organizations and whoever wants to give to Pitt, you know, the old Nixon and old theaters that don't exist anymore, I guess little theaters. I don't know much about it, except that it's fairly flourishing, and I have seen the Playhouse stuff.
And where the name comes from, Curtis, you know?
Yeah, there was a guy named Ford Curtis, who I think was a professor at Pitt at one point. I mean, obviously he's not alive anymore, but I don't know much about him.
You still have your notes? Because I have some questions now. Or do you want to...
The only other thing I want to add is that in 1995, I'm not thrilled about this, I taught a course in film at Chatham College, only for one semester. The students didn't like it, I didn't like it, they didn't like me, I didn't like them, and it was mutual. However, I think it was because our expectations of each other were not very good. I'm a pretty good teacher, and I have the students really like me. But it didn't work at Chatham. And I want to just add that as a final filler for this. I also want to add again that my mother and father had guests in their house like Roberta Peters and Leopold Stokowski, not my grandmother as indicated on the tape. And the thing about that is they would have all these guests and my mother would say to me, now Dickie, you can come downstairs and we want you to come down to the party. And I was very shy in those days and I refused. And so I missed tons of people who came to my mother and father's home on Fair Oak Street where we lived. And where I grew up, God knows what I missed. I understand Brooks Atkinson in the New York Times was also in that house, in that little living room downstairs. But I thought I wanted to correct that.
Fair
Oak Street. I don't know if it's been mentioned, but I'm mentioning it again just in case. It was 5475 Fair Oak Street at the corner of Fair Oaks and Wilkins, and it had trees all around it. The guy who now has it has changed it somewhat different than the way we did it. Again, I want to mention that Bertha Florsheim, my grandmother, was the first woman ever appointed to a mayor's council in the United States, and she was appointed in 1922 to the Department of Public Welfare. I do not at this point know who the mayor of Pittsburgh was at that point. I think that's it, except that, let me see if there's any additional things I want to add to this, but probably not. There is the business of getting a hold of Bill Miller, who can talk about the Enoch Rao Club, which was a flourishing club in Pittsburgh of orphan children of all kinds who, and this organization, it seems to me, lasted at least 20 years from 1920 to 1940. But that's all I know. Okay, that's it for the moment.
Okay. There are a few things. We talked about it before you returned. You talked about this before we turned the tape recorder on. We had quite a meeting here. The history of the Pittsburgh Playhouse. In our notes, your father evidently started a lot so that your mother.
Right.
Excuse me, one more second, so I won't have to interrupt you at all. Was the Tree of Life, the old synagogue, the Tree of Life, in that vicinity? And do you have any? You know that.
I'm going to say I think that is the case. That synagogue was built in 1906, and in 1951. I believe, the Pittsburgh Playhouse Association, the Pittsburgh Playhouse, purchased that building. The reason for that was that in 1949, when my father was head of the Pittsburgh Playhouse, he decided to embark on a very ambitious program in which the Playhouse was to be moved to where the Howard Johnson's eventually was on the Boulevard of the Allies, and which is now, I think, a Marriott.
Right, across the street from the Isleys, the old Isleys.
Correct. And to that end, he enlisted famous people around the country, especially in the New York area, to support this big capital campaign to move the theater to that site. And people like Joe Melziner, who was then at that time one of the premier set designers in New York and theater designers, he brought in. He got Thornton Wilder, a famous playwright of our town, to lend his vote of confidence to the project. Brooks Atkinson, who was then the number one drama critic on the New York Times, and many others. And the idea was to raise the money, probably around $1 million or $2 million. In those days, that was a lot of money. But what happened was that in 1950, the Korean War came along, and the board felt that they didn't have the money and the steel was running out to build this. I have the designs of this building, the theater. It's absolutely beautiful, even for 1950. It's extraordinary. There was going to be one big theater and a lavish lobby and so forth. But
who was the architect?
I think Charles Stotts. I have the original designs as well of that. That was a very big blow to my father. He was president of the Playhouse from 1946 to 1949. I mean, he had worked, besides founding it, he had, of course, worked both as treasurer, as secretary, as member of the board, and now had the opportunity to be president of the Playhouse. And that was the real glory days of the Playhouse, when the subscriber list shot up to almost 12,000. And this was when he decided to do this. He was very bitter that he lost the fight. And he lost it in a specifically interesting way. My mother told me that while they were in New York, the board voted his suggestion down. You know, that kind of thing. You know, there's no love lost.
They chose to wait.
Chose to table it, and to they may have had the idea for the synagogue worked out. And in 1951, then the synagogue was sold to the Playhouse. And of course, as you know, if you know the buildings, they're right next to each other, and so of course there was a passageway added, because they actually were not
connected,
and so the connections went on, and the Playhouse then had what is now the Rockwell Theater. Now, my father enlisted many civic leaders in the 1930s, and by 1934 had gotten them together. These were the really most well-to-do, wealthiest, and civic leaders in the city who were part of the original impetus to get this theater underway. And in 1934 they formed the Playhouse, but then not until 1935 did they actually occupy the building that they now have on Hamlet and Craft Avenues in Oakland. And the Hillman Library, for example, has the, I turned over to them the original charter of this organization. And the Playhouse became the center of theater in this city, and was that way for at least 20 years. They started off with Herbert Gallendre as director, but because of his avant-garde approach to theater, they were unable to, the board felt that he was not representing the interests of the Pittsburgh community, though the Pittsburgh community was recovering somewhat from the Depression of 1929. But Gallendre did not seem to. I've seen a photograph of one of his productions, and it's pretty way out for 1936. But it's certainly way in for 19, in 1997. In fact, it's almost old-fashioned. They hired a man named Fred Burley in 1937 to become their new artistic director, and he remained on until 1964. His successes initially were incredible, and the Playhouse prospered like nothing else. It was a restaurant was added, and Frank Blandy was the head of it. I don't know the dates on all this, but there is, by the way, a dissertation on the exact origins and of the Playhouse. It was written by a man I know named S. Joseph Nassif, and it is in the Curtis Collection.